This is the voice of the Trumpet Magazine. News, economy, politics, trends, discovery, health, family, the Bible, the future. This is Trumpet Hour.
Hello, this is Joel Hilliker, managing editor of the Philadelphia Trumpet News Magazine. On today's show, we're going to hear a report from trumpet writer Jeremiah Jacques about the fifth anniversary of Russia taking over Crimea. It was 5 years ago this past Monday that after a stealth takeover of this chunk of the former Soviet Union, a treaty was signed officially incorporating Crimea into the Russian Federation. This fulfilled an important biblical prophecy, and it was part of an ongoing campaign of aggression and expansion that has continued ever since. It's a really fascinating overview of some prophetically important history. We're also going to talk about the alarming effects of how much our children are using technology. We'll have a conversation with Jörg Mardian about the fact that the use of phones, tablets, and computers by children and teenagers is actually rewiring their brains, and it's causing mental degradation that can, in some cases, be likened to dementia. In fact, there's an increase in early onset dementia among heavy technology users. You're going to want to stick around for this interview. We'll hear some good guidelines to make sure we're protecting our own children from this danger. I also want to mention, if you have an opportunity, go to our sister website, pcg.church. This is the official website of the Philadelphia Church of God. We have a new feature there on the front page aimed at answering some basic questions for those who may visit the website and to direct them to some of the church's literature and resources. For the last word on today's program, I'm going to share with you one of those answers, the simple but profound key to how to make life work. I want to begin, though, by talking about white privilege. In American society, we're being told that whiteness gives a person unfair advantages. But not only that, maleness gives a person unfair advantages, and heterosexuality gives a person unfair advantages. And identifying with your biological sex or being cisgendered, that gives a person unfair advantages. Wealth gives a person unfair advantages. And we all need to recognize this. And we need to apologize for our privilege, especially white males, and we need to take steps to rectify this imbalance by giving preferential treatment to minorities and women and homosexuals and transgenders and people in lower classes. Then we will have a truly fair world. There are prominent Democrats saying, for example, that the government should be giving reparations to black people because of the slavery in America's past. The problems in the black community today are residual effects from slavery, which was outlawed in this country in 1865, over 153 years ago. This past Monday night, CNN held a town hall with presidential candidate Elizabeth Warren, and she was asked a question about this, and here is how she answered.
Because of housing discrimination, because of employment discrimination, we live in a world where for the average white family has $100, the average black family has about $5. So I believe it's time to start the national, full-blown conversation about reparations in this country. And that means I support the bill in the House to appoint a congressional panel of experts, of people who are studying this, who talk about different ways we may be able to do it, and to make a report back to Congress so that we can, as a nation, do what's right and begin to heal. Thank you.
So Elizabeth Warren has a lot of faith in these experts to create a solution that enables us to heal as a nation. The more we study into this, the more peace and harmony we'll have. Another Democratic presidential candidate, Beto O'Rourke, he made a joke the other day that his wife was raising their three children, quote, sometimes with my help. Well, people criticized him for downplaying his wife's role or something. I'm not exactly sure what they were so upset about. But anyway, Mr. O'Rourke responded by saying this.
Not only will I not say that again, but I'll be much more thoughtful going forward in the way that I talk about our marriage, and also the way in which I acknowledge the truth of the criticism that I have enjoyed white privilege. Absolutely. Undeniable.
What's interesting is these are two white people who have tried to downplay their whiteness. Elizabeth Warren tried to pass herself off as an American Indian. In 1996, she was actually billed as Harvard Law School's first woman of color. Beto O'Rourke is using a Spanish nickname. His real name is Robert Francis O'Rourke. So why would they try to downplay their whiteness if whiteness affords such vaunted privileges in America today? It's an interesting question. It's being said that being born white means that you start at the 50-meter mark in a 100-meter dash. Now, the truth is that America is full of people who work hard, who struggle, who face setbacks, who miss opportunities and get overlooked and get pushed aside, and they're mired in debt, people who have to toil away at mundane jobs and who are effectively stuck in their circumstances. And they're getting lectures from politicians and media personalities and wealthy academics and professional athletes about white privilege, about how there's no real equality in society and we need to artificially normalize for circumstances that give one person an advantage over another. There's something terribly, terribly wrong with this thinking. And the more we indulge it, the more individual lives will be destroyed and the more we will tear our country apart. It is wrong because it's the opposite of the way God thinks. Now, among the people who are falling prey to this error, a new theory of social justice has arisen. A new term has entered the public lexicon: intersectionality. This is a way of essentially measuring your deprivation. Wikipedia says this: the term intersectionality was coined by black feminist scholar Kimberlé Crenshaw in 1989. Intersectionality represents an analytic framework that attempts to identify how interlocking systems of power impact those who are most marginalized in society. Intersectionality considers that various forms of social stratification, such as class, race, sexual orientation, age, religion, creed, disability, and gender, do not exist separately from each other, but are interwoven together. So this theory was a way that black feminists could show that feminism was ignoring racial inequality. White women were marginalized, but black women were even more marginalized. So intersectionality addresses, this is a quote, the experiences of people who are subjected to multiple forms of subordination within society. So what does this mean? Practically speaking, what this means is we're seeing this playing itself out in Democratic politics in a very specific way, and it's causing the party to turn against itself because you need to have the appropriate credentials of intersectionality. Bernie Sanders led the socialist revolution in the 2016 presidential election. He excited a lot of young people to get more involved in politics and embrace socialist thinking. But, you know, many on the left aren't very excited about him running for president again. And why is that? Rich Lowry wrote this in Politico on February 20th. Among the flaws on Sanders' resume for many progressives is one that he can do nothing about. He's a white male and an old one. In the language of the modern left, the straight, cisgendered Sanders is burdened by his utter lack of intersectionality. Bernie Sanders was asked on Vermont Public Radio how he can lead a diverse Democratic Party. And this is how he answered.
We have got to look at candidates, you know, not by the color of their skin, not by their sexual orientation or their gender, and not by their age. I mean, I think we have got to try to move us toward a non-discriminatory society.
A non-discriminatory society. That's what America is supposed to be. But you know what? Prominent voices on the left do not agree. Here are a couple of tweets from prominent Democrats. Neera Tanden, she's from the Center of American Progress. She tweeted, "At a time where folks feel under attack because of who they are, saying race or gender or sexual orientation or identity doesn't matter is not off. It's simply wrong." This is in response to what Bernie Sanders said. Former Clinton aide Jess McIntosh wrote, "This is usually an argument made by people who don't enjoy outsized respect and credibility because of their race, gender, age, and sexual orientation." They don't want a society where you're judged by your abilities and what you stand for. They want a society where you're judged by race and sex and sexual orientation. They want to level the playing field, which means you discriminate in these areas. You have to give special treatment to those who are not white, not male, not straight, not cisgendered. It's very ironic that they're trying to solve the problems of discrimination through discrimination. The less white you are, the less of all those other privileged things you are, the more deserving you are of repertory privileges. Now, the truly liberal American ideal is that race shouldn't matter. Martin Luther King had a dream, a nation where people would be judged not by the color of their skin, but by the content of their character. But now leftists inform us, oh no, race matters a lot. And so does sex, and so does class. You know, these are actually the most primitive aspects of a person's identity. Human societies have been discriminating and judging each other based on these things for all of human history. America has created a society more than any other in history where people of any race, any background, any class have a shot at making a success of themselves. And these leftists are attacking and dismantling that ideal. And they're convincing people that this nation is actually the most unfair and the most discriminatory. And somehow they're convincing people that the solution is to exalt race, sex, and class as the defining aspects of their identity. They want more diversity, but they don't want intellectual diversity or ideological diversity or diversity in ability. No, they just want diversity of skin color or sex or gender identity. That's real diversity. That is authentic diversity by their logic. Victor Davis Hanson wrote this on March 3rd. "Then diversity as a revolutionary moment was further expanded by including gays and woke women, which essentially took the initial African-American population whose plight was the aim of affirmative action and expanded it to, in theory, a majority of about 200 million Americans who were either non-white or women or both. Now the revolution cannot figure out its own hierarchy of authentic grievance groups, so it has agreed on a loose intersectionality in which over a dozen and often overlapping victim cadres agree that each degree of non-white maleness adds authenticity and become a force multiplier of left-wing radicalism. Among leftists, Kamala Harris, as black and female, trumps Cory Booker, who is just black, who trumps Elizabeth Warren, who is exposed as just female, who trumps Joe Biden and Bernie Sanders, who are reverse threefers as white, male, and heterosexual." Victor Davis Hanson calls this a sad descent into tribalism. And that's what it is. That's what it is. It's not enlightened. It's not sophisticated. It's not just. It's tribal. It is primitive. It is absurd. And it's terribly destructive, individually and nationally. You know, there are countless factors that determine success or failure in life to varying degrees. That's why you have people who overcome tremendous setbacks, poverty, family dysfunction, lack of opportunity, physical limitations, to become spectacular successes. I mean, we all love the story of the underdog who became a success. And that's why, at the same time, you have people who have enormous advantages in life become failures. Success comes from hard work. It comes from determined effort. It comes from surmounting obstacles again and again. And it comes from the occasional good break or God opening a door. The people who are complaining about white privilege are buying into a satanic lie. The lie that the path to success doesn't come by climbing to success, it comes by bringing everyone else down. Now, when you believe that, you're robbing people of the power to make the most of their circumstances. The idea is, well, you need to focus on what the world isn't doing for you. Don't count your blessings. Complain about your burdens. Don't dream about possibilities. Don't seize opportunities. Don't look for open doors. Open your eyes to all the obstacles that people are putting in front of you, all the doors they're closing in your face. That's the view of victimhood and envy and jealousy. The world is unfair. You're the victim. Those who succeed didn't earn it. They're just privileged. You didn't fail because of anything you did. It's not because you're not working hard or you're not making yourself useful or productive or you're not playing by the rules. It's because others are holding you back. As if success is a foregone conclusion unless someone else prevents that from happening. The reality is that mediocrity at best is a foregone conclusion. Failure is far likelier unless you take responsibility and step up and make something of your life. This type of thinking strips people of their responsibility. Intersectionality theory strips people of their power. It turns them into victims of the people and the circumstances around them. It traps people in their failures. And it makes them terribly unhappy because it teaches them to fixate on negatives rather than recognizing positives and blessings and opportunities. It destroys happiness. It ravages individual motivation. Here's a fact. Virtually everyone could focus on how unfair life is if they wanted to. Human nature's really good at finding ways that life should be giving us a better shake. And that's because human nature is under the sway of the prince of the power of the air, Satan the devil. This thinking comes straight from the devil. Satan likes to give people excuses for their failures. He wants to deny people a sense of responsibility that would help them to learn from their mistakes and summon the determination to succeed in life in spite of difficulties and challenges. He wants people to think life is unfair. The world is just denying them what they deserve. Well, you know, the world is unfair. It's Satan's world. Equal opportunity, truly equal opportunity, has never existed in any society in human history. America has gotten closer to offering it to people than any society ever has. And people are being duped into thinking it's the most unequal, unfair society in history. That's a remarkable coup by Satan. And it's aimed at fragmenting society and turning us against each other so we'll rip each other apart. That's exactly what we're doing. And the more we believe this terrible error and we try to, quote unquote, heal ourselves through demanding apologies for privilege and reparations for past wrongs, the more destructive this trend will become. Just watch. Just look at the fruits. This subject shows a massive contrast between God's thinking and the devil's thinking. Satan wants to focus on all the ways that we are irredeemably disadvantaged. God made all people of all races, male and female, in his image. And he wants all of us to overcome whatever disadvantages we may have in our path and to succeed. He gives each of us a measure of resources. He wants to see what we'll do with them. He wants us to take responsibility for ourselves, to make the very most of whatever opportunities we have, take full advantage of whatever blessings and privileges he provides, conquer whatever obstacles stand in our way and grow and grow and grow. He wants to give you a lot more responsibility and a lot more blessings and a lot more privileges in the future. And it all depends on what you do with those you have.
This is the voice of the Trumpet News Magazine. You're listening to Trumpet Hour.
Russia's adventurism in Eastern Europe and the former Soviet sphere just crossed an important anniversary, as we will now hear in this report from Jeremiah Jacques.
It was 5 years ago this month that Russia officially annexed Ukraine's Crimea Peninsula, illegally making the territory a part of Mother Russia once again. And that was a defining and momentous event. But to really understand this critical recent history and what it signifies for the future, we have to back up to the 1980s. During the 80s, the Soviet Union was a powerful entity. Russia was the lead nation in the Union, and it also included Ukraine and Georgia and Belarus, Lithuania, Latvia, Estonia, Moldova, Uzbekistan, Kazakhstan, Kyrgyzstan, Tajikistan, Turkmenistan, Azerbaijan, and Armenia. Under the Soviet hammer, all of these nations and all of their various peoples were forged into one mighty superpower. It was a tremendously powerful nuclear-armed bloc, and it was all under the control of the Russian leadership. But by the end of the decade, the Soviet Union's economic, social, and political problems were reaching a breaking point, and it began to come unraveled. At the end of 1991, the Soviet Union collapsed, leaving behind Russia and 14 orphan republics, which became independent nations. When the Soviet Union collapsed, the West rejoiced, proclaiming it a victory for liberty and a triumph for democracy. Most former Soviet nations were grateful for their new independence, and they began to rebuild freer societies. But for Russia, it was a humiliating defeat. For the next decade after the Soviet Union's collapse, Russia was a depleted power outside the mainstream of world affairs. It was a time of economic chaos and political instability. When Vladimir Putin became Russia's president, around the year 2000, the nation was still in crisis, but he aggressively consolidated the country socially, politically, militarily, and economically. And in 2005, he made a statement that gave great insight into his goals and ambitions. He said, quote, "The demise of the Soviet Union was the greatest geopolitical catastrophe of the 20th century." That century saw World Wars I and II happen, and all of the unspeakable atrocities that occurred during them, the Holocaust, the tens of millions killed, and the beginning of the age of nuclear war, when mankind for the first time ever had the power to extinguish all life from the planet. But in Putin's mind, none of this was as catastrophic as the collapse of the Soviet Union. Putin views that collapse as the greatest geopolitical catastrophe of the century because it decimated Russia's power in the world. It ended the era when Russia's leaders controlled those 14 nations and all their people. So Putin lamented the collapse of the Soviet bloc. And 3 years after making that statement, he took a major step toward rebuilding it. This was in early August of 2008, and Russian forces invaded the former Soviet nation of Georgia. Russia quickly overpowered Georgian forces and then asserted control over about a fifth of Georgia's internationally recognized territory. And suddenly, that was back under Russian control, just as it had been during the Soviet era. This was a major geopolitical event, and it sent reverberations around the globe. A few days after the invasion, when the dust was still settling on that Georgian conflict, Trumpet editor-in-chief Gerald Fleury wrote a landmark article. This was published on August 22, 2008, and it said, quote, "Russia's attack on Georgia in August marks the beginning of a dangerous new era in history. This was the first military strike of a rising Asian superpower, and there will be more." End quote. Mr. Fleury then went on to specifically name which other former Soviet nation Russia would set its sights on next. He wrote, quote, "Today you have Western leaders trying to also bring Georgia and Ukraine into NATO. I don't believe Russia will ever allow that to happen. Will a crisis occur over Ukraine? That area is the breadbasket of Russia, and surely Russia's willing to wage war over that as well." End quote. Some of those who read that 2008 article may have dismissed it and forgotten about it a short time later. But about 5 years later, political crisis broke out in Ukraine. On November 21st of 2013, Ukrainian President Viktor Yanukovych abruptly announced that he was pulling Ukraine out of an agreement with Europe to more deeply integrate Ukraine with the EU. This announcement came after Yanukovych had held a secret meeting with Vladimir Putin, during which Putin pressured him to pull out of that EU deal and to instead work toward bringing Ukraine back toward closer alignment with Russia. Right around this time, Mr. Fleury published another landmark article about Vladimir Putin's role in Bible prophecy. He highlighted Revelation 9:16, which describes an Asian force of 200 million soldiers fighting in World War III. And he also discussed Ezekiel 38:2, which states that this force will be led by the prince of Rosh, Meshach, and Tubal. That was the Young's literal translation of the passage. And Mr. Fleury explained that Meshach and Tubal are early names corresponding to modern Russian cities, and that Rosh is a variation of an ancient name for Russia. And he wrote, quote, "When you study these scriptures alongside current events revealing modern Moscow's imperialist direction, you see that Vladimir Putin could well become the leader of that gigantic army of the East. I strongly believe Vladimir Putin is going to lead the 200 million man army. Just look at the power he already has." End quote. Well, shortly after Yanukovych's announcement about aligning Ukraine more closely with Russia, Ukraine's pro-European citizens were furious. About 500,000 of them took to the streets for mass protest. These people didn't want to see Ukraine controlled by Russia once again. For weeks, they protested and demanded that Yanukovych step down. In February of 2014, the protests grew more and more violent. At least 67 people died in demonstrations that month. And on the 22nd, Yanukovych fled the presidential palace and eventually went into exile in Russia. Meanwhile, little green men began showing up on Ukraine's Crimean Peninsula. These were Russian special forces, as it was later confirmed, but they all had their insignia removed from their uniforms. And they seized the parliament building there in the Crimean region, and they raised the Russian flag. By the end of 2014, these unmarked troops, along with pro-Russian Crimean militias, had taken up positions around two airports and a Coast Guard base in Crimea, and they had seized numerous government buildings. Ukrainian officials, desiring to avoid more bloodshed and more provocation from Russia, ordered the Ukrainian military not to resist the Russians. And all the while, even though it was clear to analysts that these were Russian operatives and Russian forces, Russia remained silent. On March 11th, as Russian operatives grew increasingly aggressive, Crimea's Supreme Council and officials in Sevastopol announced that they would hold a referendum about whether the people of the region wanted to join Russia. The referendum was constitutionally illegal, and the vote had too many irregularities to list. It was a sham, basically held at gunpoint. But for Putin, it worked. On March 18th, 2014, 5 years ago this month, the treaty was signed to incorporate Crimea, including Sevastopol, into the Russian Federation. And much of eastern Ukraine was also left in a state of frozen conflict that gives Russia de facto control over it. So Putin had returned some of the most strategically important parts of the old Soviet geography in Ukraine to Russian control. He had made a major advance in his goal of rebuilding the Soviet Empire's power, exactly as Mr. Fleury had forecast would happen 5 years earlier. In the May 2014 issue of the Philadelphia Trumpet, Mr. Fleury wrote about the significance of what had taken place in Ukraine. He wrote, quote, "In a stroke, Putin redrew Ukraine's borders. Before the West realized exactly what was happening, Russia had captured Crimea. Russia succeeded in swallowing another nation's sovereign territory. And then Mr. Fleury explained that Putin's actions were fulfilling Bible prophecy. He reiterated his prophecy about Putin fulfilling the role of the Prince of Rosh, or the Prince of Russia, mentioned in Ezekiel 38:2. And he explained that the increasing aggression of Putin's Russia would play a big role in causing Europe to unite. He wrote, quote, "The fear you see in Europe because of events in Crimea is going to cause 10 leaders in Europe to unite in a sudden and dramatic way, and in precise accordance with the Bible's description of that European empire." In his booklet, The Prophesied Prince of Russia, Mr. Fleury later wrote that, "Though the direction of Putin's Russia shows that the world is on the fast track to global catastrophe, there's also profound hope tied into these developments." He explained that the fact that Putin is now in power and behaving so aggressively proves that the most hope-filled event in mankind's history is very near. He wrote, quote, "Mr. Putin's warfare is going to lead directly into the second coming of Jesus Christ. Vladimir Putin is a sign, literally a sign, that Jesus Christ is about to return. This is one of the most inspiring messages in the Bible. What we are seeing in Russia ultimately leads to the transition from man ruling man to God ruling man. And it's almost here. It's just a few short years away."
Thank you, Jeremiah. It is quite extraordinary when you lay out all that history. And I was trying to think, I don't think we've done that before, where we've just connected all the dots and assembled all of the information in the way that you did there. One thing that strikes me is just how masterfully Putin went about that strategy from the very beginning and managed to do it in a way that essentially evaded international response. Everything was always done incrementally and with enough under the radar that nobody responded to it.
Yes, that was a brilliant part of this strategy that really caught the West off guard. You know, if he had rolled tanks across the border with Russian flags on them and went in there guns blazing, you know, Ukraine's not a NATO member, but I think that it would have alarmed many in the West, and it probably would have evoked the Budapest Memorandum, which is a treaty that the U.S. and some European nations signed with Ukraine. And maybe they would have gone to Ukraine's defense. But since he did it so surreptitiously and just with these unmarked troops and very gradually and incrementally, just kind of these people start popping up and, wait a minute, are they Russian? Or maybe these are just pro-Russia Ukrainians,
right?
Of which there are many, especially in Crimea. So it was brilliant because it was shadowy and underhanded. It wasn't your grandfather's war where you can just look at the banner man there and know exactly who's on which side. And it really did prevent a Western response.
So this was probably the most dramatic of several moves that Putin's Russia has made here in the time since then. Maybe you could bring us up to speed with how this has kind of fit into a larger strategy that he's unfolding.
Yeah, sure. Well, as I mentioned there, the first move would have been that one on Georgia in 2008, but it was not nearly as momentous as the 2014 Ukrainian moves, mostly because what happened in Georgia was a de facto Russian control. They didn't officially take Georgian territory. Those two states, South Ossetia and Abkhazia in Georgia, are now under Russian control, but not officially. So it's kind of interesting that with Crimea, Russia did make it official. You know, although in eastern Ukraine, they have de facto control over Luhansk and Donetsk, some of those eastern states there. But with Crimea, it's official, you know. So it is part of that strategy of rebuilding the union. And we've also spoken on a recent episode about Belarus, which was a former Soviet state. And Russia is using different tactics there. It seems like if there is an assimilation of Belarus into Russia, that it would not be militaristic. It would be more with political and economic pressure. So we'll have to wait and see what happens there. But the commonality between all of those countries and Moldova as well, where Russia's doing some similar, it has a breakaway region there that's also under Russian control. So the common thread is just these countries that used to be part of the Soviet Union are now being drawn back into it, whether it's in part or whole.
Yeah. Well, anything that you would direct people to read for more information on the prophetic significance of what's happening here?
Yes. Mr. Fleury, I quoted a little bit from his booklet, The Prophesied Prince of Russia. Very powerful booklet that puts all of this in the context of Bible prophecy and just shows how dangerous these moves are and what it's leading to. You know, the fact that it is leading to global catastrophe. But then he also spends a lot of time showing just how much hope there is in these and how, as I quoted earlier, how Vladimir Putin is a sign that we're just about to transition into a new age of godly rulership and godly governance on earth that will bring an end to all this suffering and crisis.
We've been talking to trumpet writer Jeremiah Jacque about the five-year anniversary of Russia taking over Crimea. He has written an article about this that was posted this past Monday on the anniversary itself, How Russia Conquered Crimea, a five-year retrospective. Go check that out on thetrumpet.com. Thank you very much, Jeremiah.
Thanks for having me.
This is Trumpet Hour with Joel Hilliker.
A lot of young people use technology, even very young people. Many parents find the phone or the tablet an easy way to keep their kids quiet. But experts are saying this technology use is having some terrible effects on our children and impairing their brain health. It's creating a cognitive condition in young people called digital dementia. To talk about this, we have from his office in British Columbia a man who often speaks to us about health-related questions, nutritionist and personal trainer Jorg Mardian. Hello, Jorg.
Hello there.
So this is a very interesting subject, a bit outside your usual subject matter, but still very health-related nonetheless. What got you looking into this subject?
Well, this is actually exploding. It's a subject that I think every expert in any field should look at, and especially anybody with children.
Yeah.
It's a family matter when it comes right down to the crux of it. What does it do? It destroys physical health and it destroys mental health. So I think it falls well within the sphere of what we do within, you know, natural health. So if we're looking at it and saying, is this benefiting us? No, then let's have a look at what we can do with it.
Well, describe the extent of the problem that we're talking about here. How hooked are our kids on technology?
Well, there's the rub right there. So I was looking at a Kaiser Family Foundation study, and they're really good at parsing out the information that you need with that. And, you know, they're looking at this as a 24-hour access problem. Mm. I mean, we're hooked up 24/7 right now. And so young people and this entertainment media use has risen so dramatically. So what they're looking at is 8 to 18-year-olds.
Okay.
That age. And they call them the M2 generation. I've never heard of that, but they say they're highly technological children whose lives revolve around 24/7, 365 day a year internet connection. Quite the title.
Wow.
And but get this. And I couldn't believe the extent of the problem, because I mean the average child or young person here uses 7.5 hours of time online a day. Wow.
That's remarkable. So how much of this, do you have any idea how much is say at school or school related stuff and how much is just their own volition?
That's unless you get really, really specific into those studies. I mean, they're really guessing as to what they use. I would say schooling is a big problem. I mean, their experts are actually calling now for kids to get off their cell phones. But a lot of schools are now, I'm even hearing here in Canada, they're saying, look, no more cell phones because you can't teach these kids anything.
Right.
Try to get somebody's head out of a cell phone. It's really, really hard. But there's no actual, there's nothing I could pin down in the difference in time. What we do know is that, 88% of American teens use the web, wherever they use it, to connect, to socialize, to gather information, or to entertain themselves.
Mm-hmm.
So now, you know, what does that do? Well, usually when I grew up, we'd play outside, right?
Right.
You play online. You meet kids online. We used to join clubs or organizations, right? Well, now they fraternize on social media.
Right.
And we used to go out and I'd hand in applications for work. I pound the beat, you know, but now they email them or they use LinkedIn. And what they're getting is these little snippets of information, little chunks, boom, 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 that never really connect with the brain, that you never really digest.
Yeah.
You know, and what it really does is it's a shallow, superficial, instant connection to a digital world, you know. And what the American Psychological Association, they call it an addiction, an uncontrollable compulsive behavior in the face of negative health or social consequences. So despite, even if you know what it does to the mind and the body, and I'm really talking to parents here.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, if you talk to the kids and say, look, this is bad for you. I mean, this is an education problem. So I'm talking to parents. Parents have to recognize this. And I'm a parent.
Yeah.
You know, and this was a staggering study for me, the extent of it, you know, and these kids spend so much time on there. And, you know, we have these kids who are so busy processing all this information from all directions. They're losing actually the ability to think and feel properly, to act in a proper way in the outside world rather than this fantasy world that they're stuck in.
So there are a lot of articles out there of effects that, like, increased cyberbullying and kids that have, the more attached they are to social media, the more depressed they get and that type of thing. You're talking about, like, what's happening cognitively to their ability to think because of all of this connectivity. Describe, maybe you could just get into more detail. What are we talking about? Digital dementia. This doesn't sound so good.
No, because I tried to take a different take on this. We know you can get obese.
Right.
We know you can get depressed. You know, we know these things. We've known about them. And it doesn't, it's like saying, look, you're eating the junk food and you're gaining weight. It doesn't really hit people anymore. But when you look at what the root cause is, and I looked at how kids start with this, and they start at less than 1 year old,
mm-hmm.
you know, so roughly about 50% of kids are on these devices at 1 year old. When you get to 2 years old, it hits almost close to 80%.
Wow.
So there's the problem. Now there's, in 2012, Manfred Spitzer, he was he's German. He published a book called Digital Dementia. And this is what it really came from, what we and our children are doing to our minds. And he said that not only is it causing us to be addicted, because even addictive, if you say that, it doesn't really cause an alarm, does it? To me it does, maybe perhaps to you, we would take it serious. But he said it's actually destroying the brains of young people. Now that caught my attention. You know, so how is it destroying the brain? Well, the young mind is still developing. It's what we call plastic, very malleable at those ages, right? You're still developing neuron paths that are formed in response to all the stimuli and input that you receive from the world as you're learning. So if those kids outsource their mental facilities to a screen all day, then the brain doesn't have that ability to build up memory skills the way that you would in the outside world. Attention span, critical reasoning, language acquisition, or even reading and learning abilities, they're all stunted And this is proven. Now, there's one side of science that says, look, it's not really proven. And then there's another emerging side of science that says, yes, it is. And we're looking at this, you know, just logically and saying, what are these kids doing most of the time? Can we really ignore this? And, you know, another part of this is if you toss in video games, that's a really good one too, because it utilizes the dopamine function in a brain that's activated in the same way as you would with a hard drug. It's the same pathway. So this, it's really violent the way the brain works when you're on these games, especially these shooter games. And you can actually have withdrawal symptoms. So there's an addictive behavior with that that gives these kids irritability and anxiety and sadness. You know, they're all destructive things. You know, this started in South Korea in a study. And what just blew me away. Now, usually it's about 50 to 55 years old, you start to see some dementia symptoms in people. If you're not using your mind properly. Now, this study, South Korea study, where they're the most connected kids in the world in South Korea.
Okay.
It says a 15% of young adults are going to suffer onset, early onset dementia.
Wow. So it's actually they're drawing a connection between the amount of technology use at a young age and what happens with as you get older, the kind of cognitive decline that you see in people of senior years.
Well, it might even be beyond that, because I was shocked that it said this deterioration. They're linking that. They're saying it rivals that of patients that would suffer a head injury or have a psychiatric illness.
Wow.
I mean, you can't make this stuff up. And besides that, you're reducing all these learning and attention abilities, and you get this massive depression coming on. There's one lady, she wrote a piece in The Atlantic, and she's been studying upward shifts in depression and suicidal thoughts. Now, not just depression, I'm talking about I want to take my life type of despondency. And she's gone back to the 1930s. So she's got this all graphed out. And she said around 2012, she's noticed the sharpest rate of increase since the 1930s. Now, we know that roughly around that time, you know, between 2005, it started, and then it would take a few years for kids to gather all these iPhones and tablets and computers and to get them together in their rooms. We're not just getting them en masse. But about 2012, we started to get really connected. And so we see the connection between the digital media and the way that these kids are thinking. And almost every study shows a really clear picture. Teens or young people who spend more time on screen activities are more likely to be deeply unhappy. They're disinterested, disengaged from the real world. And quite frankly, they're completely unprepared for the adulthood.
Mm-hmm. You know? So I think you've made a pretty strong case here. I imagine a lot of people would be convinced, yes, this is a problem. And a lot of it is even just with the eye test. If you have a conversation with young people, you may notice some of these things personally. You're always really good at giving us action steps. What do we do about it? This one seems like there could be some pretty simple type things that we could that we could do, but maybe you could just give us your prescription.
Right. And I'll tell you right away, it won't be popular with the young people. It's just not going to be. You're going to have a fight. But I think that's where adults just need to say, look, this is so bad that I need to implement this. So one of the things that experts say is don't start young. Just severely limit young people. And, you know, and make sure that, especially before 12, they're even saying anywhere before 15, you shouldn't, it's hard to do. But if you're going to limit it to about an hour a day, the digital media, and just make sure you're not doing it, you know, from 8 years on and younger. And if you do see your children depressed or irritable, you've got a problem. It's an addiction problem if you cut them off. I mean, that's the sign of it. So control the situation and either limit that device, those, or order a digital shutdown of your home for a while. Now, what I like to do as well is there's wonderful software out there. It's a parental control software that allows you to set time limits and block unwanted sites and behaviors. And they're really good. They're really hard to break. And but of course, that shouldn't replace proper education with the children as well. And I would say as a last point is spend quality one-on-one time with your children.
Right.
You know, go places together, engage in conversation, have family activities, because what these things do is they replace, they give it, the kids a healthy environment, a healthy way to think, and they replace that artificial digital environment that's causing all these problems.
Those are really good points. It does seem like so much of the appeal of that, it does draw you away from that normal human interaction. And those social skills that are so critical to life, those are ones that really do need to be developed and focused on, and kids need to be educated in just how to have normal conversations. They need to be practicing those types of things. And we as parents can do a lot to help with those things for sure. Well, we really appreciate that. We've been talking with nutritionist and personal trainer Jörg Mardian about digital dementia and the effects of technology on our children and what we can do to reverse some of those negative effects. He's working on an article on the subject. You can watch for that on thetrumpet.com. Thank you very much, Jörg.
It's been my pleasure.
It's time for today's last word.
I am come that they might have life and that they might have it more abundantly. This is the marvelous promise Jesus Christ made in John 10 and verse 10. Are you living the abundant life Jesus came to earth to provide you? The vast majority of people are not. They're suffering injustice, alienation, fracturing families, materialism, sexual perversion, spiritual emptiness. There's a cause for these problems. Jesus came to reveal and instruct human beings on how to live the abundant life. But we have ignored and rejected that way. We prefer to live life as we see fit. But God wants you to live a meaningful, fulfilling, purposeful, prosperous, happy life. He created us. He intends us to be happy, to enjoy pleasurable, satisfying, rewarding lives. Contrary to what so many people apparently believe, God never denies us happiness, joy, or pleasures that are really good for us and good for other people. As our Creator, He knows the way to the abundant life. And He went to extraordinary, miraculous effort to ensure that you and I can read His instructions on how to achieve that. The Bible is His guidebook for life, His instruction manual on how to make life work. Through His Word, God explains that way, what He calls the more excellent way in 1 Corinthians 12 and verse 31, the way of His perfect love. This way of life builds a strong, intimate relationship with your Creator. It builds cooperation and peace with fellow man. It builds strong marriages, joyful children, happy families. It's the way of productivity and responsibility, the way of virtue and generosity, of moderation and contentment. This is another statement that has remarkably grown controversial in today's world. God's perfect way of life is spelled out in the law of God. Many people have been taught to think of God's law as a burden or a curse, but Romans 7 and verse 12 calls it holy and just and good. King David wrote, "The law of the Lord is perfect, converting the soul. The testimony of the Lord is sure, making wise the simple. The statutes of the Lord are right, rejoicing the heart. The commandment of the Lord is pure, enlightening the eyes." That law can be summarized in one word, love, There are several scriptures that talk about that. Jesus Christ said this, "Think not that I am come to destroy the law or the prophets. I'm not come to destroy, but to fulfill. For verily I say unto you, till heaven and earth pass, one jot or one tittle shall in no wise pass from the law till all be fulfilled." That's in Matthew 5. Take a practical example. The seventh commandment states, "Thou shalt not commit adultery." God gave this law to safeguard marriage and to govern man's use of sex. And many studies have proven that individuals who keep this law have healthier, longer-lasting marriages. A husband and wife who are entirely faithful, denying their lusts and keeping this law, will have a stronger, happier relationship. Ignoring and breaking this law has resulted in tremendous cost, mistrust and heartache, shattered families, rampant divorce, increased abortions, fatherless children, venereal disease, spiritual emptiness, and countless other problems. You know, this is living proof of the relevance and the priceless value of God's law of love. Obey it and reap the rewards. Break it and you will end up broken. Here's another practical example. God's word commands tithing, giving a tenth of your income to God for his work. Now, God actually challenged us to prove that this law is still active by keeping it. Malachi 3:10, he says, "Bring you all the tithes into the storehouse that there may be meat in my house. And prove me now herewith, says the Lord of hosts, if I will not open you the windows of heaven and pour you out a blessing, that there shall not be room enough to receive it." What a marvelous promise of God's law being the path to the abundant life. God's word provides timeless foundational understanding of how to make every aspect of life a success. Relationships, marriage and family, work, finance, communication, health, and on and on and on. It shows how to navigate life's challenges and trials successfully, how to maintain positive and peaceful thinking, how to manage stress, how to avoid traps of materialism, excess, and addiction, how to build a good reputation, how to lead a fulfilling life of learning and overcoming and growth. It teaches how to build a robust relationship with God through repentance and baptism, prayer and Bible study. It shows how to yield yourself to God so he can empower you with his Holy Spirit, so you can exhibit fruits of holy, righteous character like love, joy, peace, and self-control. Jesus Christ said, "Man shall not live by bread alone, but by every word that proceeds out of the mouth of God." That is the formula for the abundant life Christ promised. Live by every word. Will you take advantage and follow the formula? If you want more biblical instruction on the abundant life, join our email service, Signposts. The Trumpet's publisher, the Philadelphia Church of God, has this newsletter to give readers and listeners like you plain, simple, actionable insight to help you to get to know your Bible and to live the abundant life. To sign up, visit pcg.church online and type your email address in the box labeled an invitation. It's easy, it's free, and it'll help you start tapping this priceless resource to make life work. I'm Joel Hilliker, and that'll do it for today's Trumpet Hour. You can send any thoughts on today's program to letters@thetrumpet.com. Thanks to our technical staff, Dwight Falk and Josh Sloan. Thanks to my guests, Jeremiah Jacques and Jorg Mardian. I'll leave you with this thought from Alexander Solzhenitsyn. "Do not pursue what is illusory, property, and position. All that is gained at the expense of your nerves decade after decade and can be confiscated in one fell night." Thank you for joining us on Trumpet Hour. Until next time, keep watching your world.
You've been listening to Trumpet Hour on Trumpet Radio, 101.3 KPCG, and online at kpcg.fm. Understand your world.